position number 16808, Rule 8.
Red Spittle's Rule 8.
Yes, so, you know, the animosity, a part of it, came from the fact that they were dressed, well, as good as our officers in their dress uniforms. I mean, ordinary ranks, their walking out dresses were smart, they were cut, they were tailored, and we were just lumbered with our old battle dresses, which even their best battle dress didn't compare to the Americans' walking out dresses. And, of course, they was always got medals, not actual medals, but some insignia where we would wear ribbons, which we hadn't got because we hadn't got any. And so with all the brass buttons and the things, the USA insignias on the tunics, they looked really smart, you know. They stuck out like a sore thumb to us, you know. And of course the fact that money-wise they could chuck it about, and with their PX as compared to Air Naffy, they had such luxuries there. You know, I think they could sort of go in there and like a general store and buy anything. I mean, with us, we couldn't just go in and buy anything we liked. We used to have a ticket every week with items that you could purchase, but they had to be ticked off, you know. And although you could go in the Naffy and buy extra soap or razor blades or things like that, there was nothing like what you might call luxuries. No luxuries with the Americans. I mean, in their PXs, it was like a big modern store. You know, they had every facility and everything. Consequently, this was passed on, and although it wasn't bothering me because I was a married man anyway, and I always felt that, you know, you couldn't go about like single lads could. The Americans, I mean, the girls made a beeline for them straight away. If it was a comparison or a choice between a bloke in a battle dress and a Yank in his, you know, he was going to be the winner, because the Yank could put his hand in his pocket seemingly at any time and pull out handfuls of money, you know. And although this animosity was terrible during the war, it's between the Americans and the rest of the world, as you might say, you know.
So why didn't it apply to black GIs? Why did it all this not apply to black GIs?
Well, mainly, I suppose, because they were still segregated in America. And when the white Americans came over, there were still times when black Americans came into the pubs. And they was accepted. I mean, an English Tommy would perhaps buy him a drink. And the period, the few months that we were there initially with these black Americans, it was long enough for us to become associated, and they accepted that, you know, that we would speak to them and that they could speak to us on a level term. And this again didn't go down well with the white Americans, that the British or the Allies, as we were, whatever nationality, whether we were Australians or whatever, accepted the blacks on a level pegging. You know, in a pub, if you went up to get a drink, these blacks would step back and you'd say, "No, it's all right, mate, you're next." And it took time for them to accept that we didn't feel that we had a priority, that they were level with us. The white Yanks couldn't understand this at all, because if they'd have been in a place and the black men had been there, they almost had told him to get out. But yeah, because of this segregation in America, it still existed in the American forces in this country.
But did not the black GIs also have greater access to these luxury goods than the British Tommy?
The fighting men did, I think, yeah. But these Labour battalions, I think they were a different kettle of fish altogether. Because even in our own forces, you talk to old soldiers, and they talk about the Pioneer Corps. Now, until I saw the Pioneer Corps actually working, when we went up to Arnhem, I'd always basically accepted that the Pioneer Corps was comprised of people who were not necessarily A1. That there was a physical reason why they were in a Pioneer Corps and could not be in a fighting unit, as you might say. Completely overlooking the fact that they had to be engineers and technicians and skilled men. But the pioneers, you see, until after Dunkirk, the Pioneers Corps were never armed. They never carried weapons until after Dunkirk. And it was only realised then that they'd got all these hundreds and hundreds of Pioneer Corps. When the German Blitzkrieg started, they couldn't defend themselves and fight. All they could do was run or be took prisoner. And it wasn't until after Dunkirk that the Pioneer Corps were armed, the same as ordinary infantrymen, and did training. And so they became basically ordinary soldiers, except they were doing labouring rather than frontline fighting, you see. But there was always this stigma of Pioneer Corps and also the Catering Corps. It's funny because people, like, you get it in comics, even on the television in comics. Somebody will say about somebody who's putting himself up in a comic situation, he's the major, you see. And then they tip in and say, they find out that he was in the pay corps, you see. And immediately there's a down to it. And so you got this stigma. Not right, of course, because they were as valuable as the man who was firing the bullets, and as necessary. But there was a stigma. He was only fit for the Pioneer Corps, you see. And so with these American labour thing, I don't think the labour companies, these black Americans, were ever armed. They were just there for labouring. And whereas the black fighting units were a different class altogether. And I would think that they had probably a different social in-camp thing. I don't know from experience, but I would think that they probably got a priority of comforts, put it that way, than probably these labour battalions had with their PXs. But I don't know from experience. But there was always this animosity about the Americans in Britain during the war because of their free way of, you know, the character of them. They're so free and easy and social, you know, that it sort of jarred, you know. When they came over, we'd been fighting, well, not fighting, but we weren't involved in a war for, well, 2.5 years before the Americans came in. And we were down to rations and all this, that, and the other. We got the blackout. We'd been living with the blackout. And they'd suddenly come out from a country that was brilliantly lit, sunshine, walk freely about, no bombs and nothing. I come over here. It was like a breath of fresh air. You know, it was a wonderful thing that they suddenly, all these forces had dropped in the middle of us. And, you know, it was totally alien to the way of life that we'd been accustomed to, you know. And, let's say, it was an amazing situation, really. But when these blacks went and the whites came, and we were at Ogbore St George, it wasn't long before this situation of segregation came because of trouble between the troops.
Were you in any fights?
I wasn't particularly, no, because I used to follow my father's advice. And he always used to say, when you're out with the boys, there's a gang of you, you're enjoying yourselves, and you can see when trouble's coming, don't wait to see what happens, make sure you're not there when it does happen. And so that was the policy I adopted during the war. I mean, you could sense these problems, like, you know, some little bit of an argy-bargy, you think, well, you know what's going to happen there, so plenty more pubs, you can go to another one. So I personally never got involved, you know, but there was always these, you know, in conversation down the tank, down the lines and that, you know, say, God, I'm going to have a fight down south. So, you know, they'd tell you about these fights and argy-bargies that went down, like, you know. But I always took care not to be there when it happened. But no, it was strange how that situation was down with Woburn St George. But then, as I say, we had a summer down there, and we had a nice little cafe over at Marlborough. And so we used to trundle across in air tanks, because we used to be able to go out, what we called put an out of action flag up. And the corps colours, the Royal Armoured Corps, was yellow and red, or claret, you know. And so we used to have a flag which we put up, just a square flag, and diagonally across was yellow and red, you see. And if it was universal, that if anybody saw a tank trundling about anywhere, apparently on its own, for no apparent reason, as long as that flag was flying, they would assume it was on trial for some defect, or, you know, that it was the fitters who took it out, they'd done some work on it, and they were giving it a run. Or for whatever reason, it was legal for it to be out, a single tank by itself, with no apparent connection to anybody, you know. And so we used to stick the old head of action flag, and this was one thing people have said to me, because I was so involved, I really took to tanks, you know, liked tanks. I mean, a lot of people were in tanks simply because they were tanks, and then when the war's finished, that's it, finished, don't want to know more about it, you see. But I've always been interested, and people have said to me, I wonder you didn't sign UNRED, you know, after the war, you carry on. And I said, well, no, I wouldn't be interested after the war, because there's so much discipline and regimentation that wasn't there during the war. I mean, in the early days, before, in 1940 and that, when they were expecting parachutes and invasion and all that, totally, you know, the freedom that we had that summer in 1940 was amazing. And one of our officers, what's his name, Rainsford, he got killed in Normandy. His family lived to say his father was a colonel. And Wardle Rainsford was one of our young officers when we first got called up. In 1940, when we got Guy Army cars, and we were down the south of England for that summer during the Battle of Britain, flying about all over the place. And as I've said to somebody once when he was talking, he said, well, can you describe? I said, yes, I said, it was like holiday cars, like being butlins on wheels, like all that summer. I said, we had a gorgeous time. And old Rainsford suddenly come into the troop line, you say, right, how about a bit of pistol practice? You go down the armoury and get a box of ammunition, and just go down, just like that, and we'll go and find an empty quarry or something, and put some anything up, some tins or anything, and just shoot your pistols off, you know. I mean, you couldn't do that in peacetime. And we got these Beezer machine guns, big Beezers and small Beezers. And one of the things we used to look for when we got in a location was these, in the south of England, there seemed to be a lot of these dugouts, as you might say, and the soil, you'd be going along a road and suddenly you'd come to a place where there was a gap. It went back about 50 or 60 yards, where there'd obviously been something taken out, soil or something, for whatever reason. And they just left there. And we used to get to know where they were, these places. And we go down there, and here we were with a 15mm Beezer machine gun, popping away there. We'd just take some tin cans and put up, bang, 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 because there were no civilian cars about much, you see, or petrol rationing and all that sort of thing. So the only vehicles were service vehicles. And at that time, in 1940, it was you could be quite isolated, you know, from killing anybody or anything. And there was all this freedom of doing it all that summer. Because it became, once we got onto tanks proper, and of course a lot of that went, we only could use the tanks when we'd fired on proper ranges and that, you know. But when we had the army cars, it was really free, you know, ammunition, and they'd go out and say, have a bit of grenade throwing, you know, find some rough ground out of the way, you know. Just take a box of grenades and they'd no bother. You couldn't do that in peacetime, you know. And so, you know, when you make a comparison of peacetime and wartime, the freedom that existed in wartime, you know, while you were training, it couldn't be repeated, not in peacetime. There'd be too much, you know, you know, hand holding back all the time. You know, I would never have enjoyed peacetime soldiering, you know. But that's how it was, you know. But there was this little cafe over at Marlborough, and so what we used to do of a Saturday or a Sunday when the camp was empty, more or less, everybody gone into town or on leave or whatever, somebody would say, "Hey, been having the tank, eh, Reds?" "Yeah, all right." I put the old flag up. And what we used to do was go around the wireless hut, because we always had attached wireless personnel, you see. I mean, we've got our own wireless people, but we always had to have attached people, like, you know, like engineers and people like that. And we also had a wireless section. Perhaps only be two blokes, you know, but they'd be allocated an hut of their own or something like that, you see. And if you were going to go out on the area, you'd go around and say, "We're going to take a tank out," and they say, "Oh, righto. Well, you better give them a number then, you know," and they give you a code, you see, and then when you got in it, you'd switch the radio on, you see, and you'd turn it in and get it into a reasonable strength, you know, need good to strength, non-perfect reception, like, you know, as long as it was, you know, near enough, say, like, you know, because most of the blokes weren't wireless operators anyway, you see, so they'd get in, switch it on, they knew how to work them, like, but they weren't trained wireless operators in every case, you see, and you turn it in, say, "Yeah, right, okay then." You do that in case anything happened to you while you were out on the area, so you could call in and tell them where you were, and the Remy or the fitters could come out to you, you see. So you're no good going out without letting the your wireless people know you were out, you see. So we're just going to let them know, and then we'll put the old flag up, trundle away across Marlborough Downs, a few miles, down to the back of Marlborough, and there used to be this little cafe. It's sort of quaint, really. It was sort of set aside. It was almost on the downs. And so we used to put the old tank in one of the depressions, put a net over, you see, and then just go in and have a cup of coffee or a cup of tea and a cake and a bun, like, you see, and then wander back to the tank and drive back, put the part of the tank back in the tank park, and that was it, like, you know. We had a few hours relaxation, like, and leisure. You know, you couldn't do this in peacetime. You couldn't just go down to Bovington and say, I'll take a Challenger 2-8and have a run across all the big plains, you know. And so, you know, there would be no comparison between wartime and peacetime. But so, you know, it was amazing, really. But anyway, we were down there for some time, and then we started to this North Africa came along, you see, Torch, the landings in North Africa. And we were in the 6th Army Division, and at that time, the divisions, tank division, comprised of two armoured brigades. And you can imagine they're colossal, that one. I mean, you've got about 360 tanks in a division. How unwieldy it must have been for the divisional commander to have all these tanks at his disposal, and all these different regiments to command, you know. And I think this was probably the time when they adopted the Russian and the German idea. That their idea was to have smaller divisions that were more mobile, because they could be more controlled and could be moved more rapidly than air divisions, which were big, you see. And so when we were there, this Torch operation started, and they took our brigade, which was the 20th Armoured Brigade, they took us out of the 6th Armoured Division totally, and the 6th Armoured Division went to North Africa in Operation Torch. Well, at that time, they took a lot of the personnel from other units, and they must have disposed of some out of the forces that actually went. And for a time, we'd got more tanks than men. They suddenly decimated our brigade of people to transfer to other tank regiments in the other brigade that they'd taken, the 6th Army Division. And it was amazing. I mean, before they split our brigade up, I was acting troop officer. I was only two stripes, and we was that, got no officers, we got nobody. And we got all these tanks standing in the tank park, and we hadn't got enough people to crew them, you know. And we used to have, every day, they used to have a tank commanders, a troop leaders conference, you see. The major would have a troop leaders conference, so what we're going to do today, you see, and then troop leader would come back and tell his troop what that troop was going to do for the day, you see. And I used to have to go to these meetings, a corporal, and there was perhaps a sergeant there, you know, and the only officers was like the major and the second in command who were real officers. The rest of us were all NCOs, acting as troop officers, you know, because we'd got nobody. And then, of course, this torch operation went, and then we filled up again with all new people, you know, and literally became a stranger in your own regiment. And we settled down again to a routine way of life. And then suddenly it was decided that the brigade would be split up and disposed, you see. And that was when the 2nd Yeomanry went up to Yorkshire to join the 11th Armoured Division. We went to a place called Little Driffield, which is close to Driffield proper. At that time, it was a sort of a Little Driffield was like a sort of a mile and a half up the road from the town of Driffield itself. And they changed us then from we'd gone back to Valentine's, and they took all their Valentine's away and gave us Crusaders, because we were going to be the heavy armoured reconnaissance regiment for the 11th Armoured Division, you see. And of course the Valentine was no use as a reconnaissance vehicle because it was too slow and cumbersome. So we had to have our old Crusaders back again, you see, which were fast and very fluid. And so we went up to there, and we were in our squadron, because what they used to do then, the squadrons would be dispersed around the area. As we were at Little Driffield, and another squadron would be at another village and another village, you see. And we were at Little Driffield, and we were down this lane, the big house on the corner, and as I recall, the road from Driffield drove up and then abruptly turned right and went off at an angle at, you know, to other places, like. And you was immediately going into the gateway to the big house that stood on the corner, you see, in its own ground. I don't know what it was called. I mean, we usually used to know the names of these houses, like Billing Hall at Northampton or Wootton Hall. And when we're down at Westbury, it was Boyer's House and all these places. But I never did know the name of the house. And we went to there, you see, and then we was just down the lane as you drove in through the gates of the big house. And immediately facing was this lane that ran straight down through the fields, more or less like a farmer's track, only a bit better quality. And at the end of it was a T-junction. It came to and then the track went off left or right. The right-hand one went back onto the main road after going by a farm, you see. And we got these Nissen huts all round this field on the left-hand side of the road, or the tank line, the lines. The tank lines were always referred to as lines. Going back to the horse days, I suppose, when they had lines of horses, so you had lines of tanks, you see, so you always referred to them as the lines. And the tanks were all down the left hand side of this lane, backed up. And originally we had a hedge there behind the tanks, you see, a normal hedge. But after a few weeks it had totally disappeared, because when you'd done any washing, clean oil, petrol, you chucked it in the edge, you see, decimated the edge, and gradually it disappeared. There was only the roots left, like, you see. And it dropped about 4 feet into the field behind, which had an amusing incident occurred because of that. But anyway, we went up there, went to Little Driffield, and that was where I fell out with Tom Gillingham over the, which I've told you about, with the lights. And the huts were all round the field. Anyway, did I relate this incident where we lost a tank? It ran away.
I think so.
No. Well, we were obviously looking forward to this second front, although we weren't. The higher authorities obviously were, you see. And so we were getting quite a rapid change of personnel. They seemed to be weeding out people who they thought were having medicals and tests. They were giving us these tests like kids do at kindergarten, like, you know, putting square blocks in brain holes and things like that, silly things like, you know. And they didn't give you any reason for this, but obviously what it was intended for was a long-term policy, that they were anticipating that certain people would not get killed or wounded, but would become mentally unstable. And to test their mentality at a given time, and I did this actually when I was downgraded from A1 to C1 in Belgium. And I did this down there again, and it was suddenly realised then why we did this up Yorkshire. I was really testing your mental alertness and making a comparison with how you did it now and how you did it then. These stupid, childish exercises that the blokes were taking a mic out, like, you know. And I thought, oh, well, they wouldn't get a true picture because it was so childish that the blokes wouldn't do it seriously. You know, if they'd have explained why they were doing it, they would have got a better reaction, more positive and practical than they did, because it was so childish that blokes were treating it as childishness, you know, instead of seriously. And I did it again when I was being tested for reassessment in Belgium. And I was eventually downgraded to C1, you see. And it was only then that I realised why they did this stupid exercises up at Yorkshire. They didn't make sense, you see, at that time, and nobody told us. But anyway, we started doing all these things, you know, and written tests and all that sort of thing. And medicals, extra medicals, more than we'd had previously. And it was obviously they'd started a system of grading for the second front business. And consequently, we started having new phases come in, you see. And then we had all these, as I was telling Mr. Dolby, then we had all these young second officers came who were going to stay with us. You know, instead of coming for a couple of months and then going off somewhere, these were not going anywhere. They were going to stay, you see, as our second officer. Because we got a permanent troop officer. Mr. Hobson was my troop officer, he was a lieutenant. And Mr. Dolby came as a second lieutenant, as our understudy, you see, to take over if Mr. Robson got killed, which he did, of course. Mr. Dolby did take over the troop when he got killed, but this was all happening at Yorkshire, you see, with all preparation that you didn't realise because nobody told you, you see. It was a secret, this second front business. And so all this was happening, but then again you had, we went up there with Crusaders, and they decided that they were not the vehicles we were going to take for the second front, and we were going to have these Cromwells, which we did eventually have. But initially they hadn't got enough to give us Cromwells to practice with, to literally say, well, they're only for training, and we'd dump those and give you some brand new ones for the real day. They hadn't got enough of those, so what they did, they gave us some Centaurs, as they were called, which were actually the intended Cromwell, but it became obsolete because it had got the same engine as the Crusader, which was a Nuffield Liberty engine, 12-cylinder. But the Centaur had been upgraded. It was going to be the Cromwell, and it was about 10 tons heavier than the Crusader. So the engine that was quite adequate and powerful enough for the Crusader became inadequate to do all the work it was required to do by in this heavier chassis, 10 ton heavier. It was too weak, you see. And so it had a limited performance to what the vehicle could do because the engine wasn't strong enough, you see. I mean, we finished up with a Rolls-Royce Meteor engine. It was actually a Rolls-Royce Merlin readapted from a Spitfire and Lancaster bomber. It was adapted to go into a tank, and it became, from the Merlin, it became the Meteor. Anyway, I mean, 650 horsepower, terrific thing, like, you know. That was the final vehicle, but initially we had these Centaurs with the Crusader engine, and they hadn't got enough of those to give us, so they gave us some Honey tanks, these American Stuarts. Strangely enough, they were nicknamed Honeys, And I always had the impression it was the Americans that would have called them Hunnies, and it wasn't, it was the British that nicknamed them Hunnies, but for whatever reason. Anyway, we then equipped with two centaurs and one Hunny to a troop. It was ridiculous, really, because we were supposed to be training. And the crew, these centaurs could not do the same work as a crusader because the engine wasn't balanced to the wind.